Hey there, this is Sophie. Before we get started in our deep dive podcast conversation today, I just wanted to let you know that if you enjoy our podcast, you might also enjoy some of the other great content we have available for you on YouTube, our blog, and on our website. Check it out, russellinvestments.com. If you were going to help me, for instance, right now, what is a good first step for somebody like me who would be interested in really, you know, genuinely wanting to make a change, wanting to not let the crises of this year go without taking advantage of them and capitalizing on them in order to learn from them for the future and build a practice that is going to be successful in the future? Where should I start? If I was going to start in one spot next week, what should be on my Monday morning agenda?
Practice assessment. We have a process that we use. We call it our Practice of the Future exercise, a simple exercise that can be done online. And you tell us what's a priority and what's not a priority. And then once we know what the priority is, then we can start to dig deeper in what needs to be done to help you with that to move forward and help you think about what is the next best action, what is the second action, and what is the third. And having someone to help you think through that as a business consultant and partner is key.
Welcome to the Helping Advisors Podcast by Russell Investments. I'm Sophie Antel-Gibert, Head of North America Portfolio and Business Consulting for Russell Investments Advisor and Intermediary Solutions Business. Now, I'm sure I'm not alone in thinking that this year hasn't looked anything like what most of us expected. Whether it be the market swings that we've experienced, or the global health pandemic that everybody has gone through, or even the societal movements that have made global news headlines around the world has felt upside down for many of us in the past few months. And at the same time, time moves on, time marches on. We are halfway through the year, and many of us are probably turning our eyes towards 2021 planning. Could it be? Could it already be here? In some ways, it feels like it's come so quickly. In other ways, it feels like it's been an eternity. And can it really only be 2021 planning? It feels a bit more like it should be 2030 planning. Regardless, that planning is probably going to look pretty different than it has in the past. Because things have changed so much. We've all learned a lot about ourselves. We've learned a lot about our business. We've learned a lot about our clients. We've learned a lot about our families and our communities. And we've maybe even learned a bit more and gained some insight into what are our priorities? What do we want to be doing? And how can we best accomplish those goals that we have for ourselves and for our business and for our team? Now, to give us some insight into what that future might look like and how we might be able to capitalize on these various degrees of crises and unexpected situations that everybody has faced this year, and be able to build on that to build the practice of the future that we are all aspiring for, I am joined today by my colleague, Tina Downing. She's a senior director and lead for our business coaching team and has over 30 years of experience working with advisors, coaching them to help them really realize what is my goal and how can I reach that maximum potential that I have envisioned for myself. So Tina, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Sophie. I'm thrilled to be here.
Terrific. So Tina, as you think about 2021 planning and how that might look different for all of us coming here in the next few weeks, what is a helpful organizing principle, or how are you thinking about what are all of the different elements of a strategic plan that I might need to consider, and how might that be different than the organizing principle I might have used in the past?
Well, it's a great question because, you know, if you think about what we've all been doing, you know, since January of this year, you know, we've all been working in the business, not necessarily on the business, right? And so we've been dealing with reactive days, trying to stay front and center with the clients constantly. And now is the time to really start to be more introspective about where you want the business to go and where the business model is going in the future. And to do that, it's a daunting task because if you start to look at all of the pieces of your practice as a whole, there's so many components of the practice. And especially now trying to work on those things, it's really important that you break it down into bite-sized pieces and look at the structure of your practice in different components, which we can actually walk through.
That would be really helpful. I like this idea of, you know, an acknowledgement that yes, the, you know, working in the business has been all consuming. Like if that's what I've been able to focus on, and that's the only thing I've been able to focus on, it sounds like you're saying I shouldn't feel too bad about that. That was actually where my focus needed to be. My clients needed me. And now, however, it makes sense to sort of transitioning back to working on the business and not just in the business. And yet let's do that in bite-sized pieces. What are some of those bite-sized pieces that you would encourage us to look at?
So when we think about the four drivers of success for an advisor's practice, there's four. There is running your business like a business owner. Now, this includes things like continuing to grow the business because it's imperative. You're sort of thinking about how to sustain the business long term. Is truly taking a step back and doing some strategic planning on what are the things that work well. And this is the perfect time to do that because you've been able to get a lot of insights into what happens when things kind of go haywire. And is the practice really structured in a way, and is your strategy put in place that actually can sustain chaotic environments like we've experienced now? It is also about what your brand is and your marketing strategy. Those are two very different things. Branding is what you want to be known for. And how are you perceived in this kind of market, in this kind of environment? Were you seen as the trusted advisor and the person that the clients called, no matter what was going on in their life, positive or negative, professionally or personally? Were you the first call or the team call that they made, other than their immediate family? It's also time to start really looking at resource allocation and time management, because especially now when we're working virtually, how effective was your team in actually executing and getting the job done? And how can you take a look at reducing the workflow and increasing capacity over time? I know for me, you know, I was an advisor for many, many years. I had to make some tough decisions about my practice over time after 9/11. Because I was trying to stay front and center with clients, but I had too many clients to be able to do that effectively. And I wasn't doing the right thing for them either and putting them in a position that I couldn't talk to them when I needed to. So we had to make some tough decisions about the practice and what the overall strategy was. We had to look at profitability. We had to look at the team and how were we equipped from an expertise standpoint, and how were we going to create risk management that really did protect us when the markets went bad, and how could we look at our processes and systems? The second piece is client-centric engagement. Were we able to deliver during a time like this when things were crazy? Were we able to deliver on the service promise that we've given to our clients? Are we able to deliver on the things that the clients value most? Whether that's reactive service and problem resolution and responsiveness, or proactive engagement and getting in front of the clients and helping them understand what might be coming next in their life, you know, and preparing for that. You know, what are the one-to-many strategies that you're using? If they're not your top clients, how are you making sure that you're covering the clients that are in the bottom 50 part of your book? The behavioral coaching. You know, that's the one thing the clients say that they value most about what you do for them. And how are you thinking about that coaching and helping them stay calm when in this state of chaos in the markets? And then process systemization, capacity management, and how can you make sure that that holistic planning process that you're doing for the clients has an execution system and an implementation system that actually works?
Interesting. So there you've mentioned the first two there, Tina. So running your business like a business owner, or thinking of my business, I guess, as a CEO would think about their business. And then the second sort of driver of future success that you mentioned was all around client-centric engagement. Am I delivering on the value proposition and on the promise that I've made to clients? And am I set up in such a way to be able to do that? That's really interesting. One area that I haven't sort of heard you say here, which is kind of interesting, because a lot of us get into the business because we love, you know, we love dealing with numbers and we love following markets and we love putting portfolios together. I noticed that so far you haven't mentioned anything about the portfolio management and about the portfolios that we deliver to clients. Might that be the third pillar or the third driver of success? How do portfolios and sort of the investment acumen that we've all worked so hard to build up, how does that fit into the drivers of success?
Great observation, Sophie. A disciplined investment strategy is the third component or the third driver of success for the future. And what I mean by a disciplined investment strategy, it goes over and above being able to put a good portfolio together from a asset allocation standpoint or a portfolio construction standpoint. It's also about taking a step back and looking at your inventory management. How many actual CUSIPs do you actually manage in the practice? And when you think about managing all of them, you know, the average advisor in the studies that we've done holds in reality about 420 something actual CUSIPs.
420 CUSIPs, individual CUSIPs, yes, in a book, a single advisor. So not a large team of advisors who might have, you know, slightly different demographics of clients, where it might make sense that as a collective whole, that whole business might hold 450 CUSIPs. But here you're saying even an individual advisor, just for their clients, they hold maybe on average 450 CUSIPs?
Yes. And you know, the maximum that I've seen so far is 1,300 CUSIPs. Scary.
Wow, that's like trying to collect CUSIPs, collecting clients and CUSIPs. Okay. I used to collect stamps. I guess everybody, you know, to each his own.
That's right. And is what you want to do in your practice being a CUSIP collector? I love the title, because as you're thinking about this and you're trying to monitor what's going on in tough markets, just look back in March of this year. How were you able to review that many CUSIPs? It's nearly impossible. The average amount of time when we do our research with our portfolio managers and ask questions of how long it actually takes to manage each CUSIP, if you're doing it properly, it's about 5 hours. And that includes listening to the research about it, looking at capital market, getting information from the managers that you might be working with. All of those things are included in that inventory management. And the key is here is that what the clients value most? You know, every year we do a survey that we ask the clients what they value most about what their advisors do for them. Behavioral coaching, the things you do over and above the asset management, and actually tax management are the top three. Managing investments doesn't even rank in the top three.
That's really interesting, because if I do the quick math, sort of back of the envelope math there. So if the average advisor has 450 CUSIPs, and in theory, it would take to do, you know, good due diligence, you're suggesting approximately 5 hours per year per CUSIP. So just doing quick math here, that adds up to over 2,000. It's closer to 2,200 hours per year. If I'm assuming I'm working, you know, a standard 40-hour work week, which I realize advisors are incredibly hardworking, so nobody is working just a 40-hour work week, but humor me for a minute. So 40-hour work week, I might be taking 2 weeks of vacation a year. That brings me to about 2,000 hours of working hours per year. And yet, if I have 450 CUSIPs in my book and I'm spending 5 hours researching each one of them, suddenly I've spent 2,200 hours out of my 2,000 hours of working hours. I've spent 2,200, so more, focusing on due diligence of my clients. And yet I hasn't even accounted probably for the time that I have actually needed to spend and wanted to spend with my clients and, you know, talking to them and meeting with them and doing discovery on them and helping them and coaching them and guiding them through markets like the ones that we just saw. Am I understanding that right, Tina?
It's exactly right. You know, and the numbers don't add up. And if you think about, you know, last week, Best Interest just came out, right? We launched last week. And this is an issue. It's a real risk for, you know, practices out there today, because with regulation Best Interest, you have to be able to justify every CUSIP that you own for any client. So I always ask advisors to take a look at their book and open up a list of clients and let me choose a client and say, open up the holdings there, and I'll point to a mutual fund and say, why do you own this for this particular client? If you can't answer that, you have work to do.
That's eye-opening, a little bit sobering. Maybe we pause there for a minute to allow everybody to breathe, because I'm panicking just hearing this, Tina.
not just you.
So that's the disciplined investment strategy. It sounds like making sure that we are aware of what it is that we own, making sure that we know, you know, like truly know in depth what it is. And I assume also making sure that it aligns with the client goals, that we know what are the client's goals, circumstances, and preferences. And does my product inventory actually cater to that? Do I have in this large inventory, in this outsized inventory that I might have, am I actually focused and applying the right products to the right clients and solving their individual and unique circumstances?
That's exactly right. And it's also about looking at even the different types of accounts that you manage, whether it's a taxable account or a tax deferred account. Do you look at different strategies for those? Because sometimes they may need to be held differently. How do your portfolios work in volatile markets? How do they work in good markets? When are you going to be rebalancing? Do you have an actual policy around rebalancing the portfolios? Many times it doesn't, and it can have a significant impact on the risks that the clients are taking over time.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up that tax component as well, because in some ways it feels like, you know, normally we sort of remember about taxes around April 15th and then we move on until next April 15th. And suddenly we're, you know, signing checks that we didn't want to sign and shipping them off to the IRS. This year, I feel like the pain of taxes has been even bigger because it's been this extended period where we all built up towards April 15th and then it got extended to July 15th. Sometimes extensions are helpful, but in this case, it feels like it just drew out the pain even longer. So I can see how from an advisor's standpoint, really focusing on taxes and helping clients make sure that they keep more of what they earn in their investment portfolios and not having to sign an unnecessarily large check to the IRS would be helpful and would be something that it sounds like clients really appreciate.
Well, that's particularly important too because of the aging demographics of our clients today. You know, the average client being somewhere between 55 and 75, and that's looking across all channels and all types of firms, is still the same average age. And it's more important than ever, especially when markets get volatile, that clients know that their needs are taken care of and they're going to have enough cash flow to live their life in dignity.
Hey, it's Julie, your productivity and readiness expert at Vessel Investments. We'll get back to the podcast in just a sec. But first, a question we hear from financial professionals over and over is, how do I make my investment practice stand out from the one across the street? We're all looking for ways to be unique. One powerful way is by becoming a tax-managed investing expert. Our latest Value of Advisors study shows that taking a tax-smart approach can provide enough value to investors that more than justifies a reasonable fee. And if you're thinking tax management sounds like too much work, don't. Because Vessel Investments can provide you with tax smart models that can help with all that portfolio management. Visit us at vesselinvestments.com to learn more and start setting your practice apart with a tax managed approach. Or then again, maybe you could just repaint your lobby. That might help too.
So that was disciplined investment strategy. So we've covered run my business like a CEO. So make sure I'm wearing my CEO hat. We've covered client-centric engagement. And now you have acknowledged that I do also do a lot in the investment space through disciplined investment strategy. What might the fourth driver of success be? I'm curious.
The fourth driver is a team approach. So you may not be on a team yet. It might be time to think about that if you aren't able to handle every client, you know, in this kind of environment that we just had. You may be thinking about your team structure. Do we have the right structure? Were we able to execute? You may also think about your own team leadership if we're truly introspective, you know, towards ourselves too, of how was I able to effectively manage and lead my team and keep them motivated and productive during this time? And was our roles really clear? And does the team understand where we're headed together? Because each activity on the team that you do every day should take you towards that vision that you have for the future. Roles then should be carried around that. So you make sure that everybody is crystal clear about what their contribution to that vision of what you're trying to create is. And then also, where are the opportunities to continue to grow as a team, not just from an expertise standpoint, but so how you're actually going to work with other people that you collaborate with for the benefit of your client. And then finally, on that collaboration kind of standpoint, is personality dynamics. You know, is the team able to collaborate? Are you able to hold each other accountable? Do you trust each other? because trust, especially in this kind of environment, is not lost in one simple incident. It's usually a death by a thousand cuts, right? Is someone didn't do what they were supposed to do. Someone didn't know that they actually had the responsibility for it. So that role clarity, accountability, and communication system that you set up to hold each other accountable and to make sure that everyone kind of knows what they're supposed to be doing is key.
Well, and presumably, I mean, I know I've spoken to a lot of advisors in the last few months, and a lot of them have said, you know, I have a great team. We've worked together for many years and everything has run smoothly. And now suddenly that we've, you know, we feel a little bit like fish out of water, where everything worked smoothly when we were in the office and we had our reminders and our post-it notes and our systems and our habits and our routines. But now that we're all, you know, suddenly, and, you know, in March and in April, suddenly everybody had to up and leave the office, be working from home. Suddenly the dynamics completely shifted. And we realized that there were gaps in our process that we weren't aware of because we had gotten so used to working in one physical space, even as opposed to suddenly having to do our jobs and our roles. And as you say, collaborate and communicate with each other under very, very different circumstances. Several advisors have also said, you know, a crisis really begins to reveal the, like, people's true personalities. Everything that we're able to sort of touch up when we're in an office setting, suddenly when everybody is dealing with so many different things and has so much pressure from so many different situations. And yes, we're all in this together, but everybody's experience of the last few months has been so unique and so different and so individual and personal that a lot of advisors have said, wow, it was really eye-opening. It was eye-opening to see what, you know, what worked and what didn't work there. Tina, maybe you can talk a little bit about that, like how as a team might advisory teams begin to kind of reflect on, okay, so what have we just been through and how do we turn this into an opportunity, as you say, right? How can we continue to grow as a team? What are some ways that you can get into that? Because I can imagine that these conversations can get sensitive very quickly as well. And obviously you want to avoid, you know, pouring vinegar into the wound.
It is key to make sure you're doing this the right way, right? Because it's been a stressful time. And I think all of our stress levels and point of breakdown is a lot, you know, lower than it probably used to be. So we have to be careful as we're going through these conversations. And the first thing, though, is to ensure that the team priorities are aligned. And there's ways to do that. I mean, we work with some of our top advisors and our clients, and some of the things that we help them do is look at those priorities, take you through an exercise that looks at these four things, you know, those four drivers of success, to say, what are our top three priorities as a team? And does the team actually agree? Because many times what I find is the team leader has their priorities, but if they haven't communicated the expectations and the vision well enough, many times the other team members don't have the same priorities. And as you go through those, you have the ability to bring the top three priorities together, because that's what that incremental change is about, choosing the first thing that you do and then the next best action for the team.
So back to your point of bite-sized approach and not trying to do too much all at once.
Yes. It's time for an assessment to really see where you're at today and then have a conversation about where the gaps are, where you want to go. Do we need to delve in closer to the actual roles and responsibilities and the tactics on the team? You know, do we need to do some sort of behavioral coaching to make sure that we're setting ground rules for communication and understanding the intent as much as the communication style that you're working with on team members? Especially when stress gets high, people default to their natural behaviors, and understanding those behaviors and the intent behind them is really important in this scenario as you're starting to make changes within the practice. Some people go through change cycles at a different pace. We have to understand that and help bring team members along the journey.
This is deep and complex. You mentioned also, you know, sort of diving deeper into roles and responsibilities. What's a helpful approach for thinking about that? You've talked about identifying what are the, you know, the team's top priorities and ensuring that they have buy-in, looking at gaps and stuff. And within that, you mentioned diving deeper into roles and responsibilities. How do you best recommend doing that?
Well, there's ways to assess the time that you're spending on things, your skill set, you know, what your natural skills are and natural strengths are, and then looking at what you're doing on the team. So a time and skills assessment is a great place to start. Looking at the roles that you have on the team, and were they adequate, you know, when you actually needed them the most? Looking at some sort of behavioral assessment to see what their natural skill set is, and are they being able to not have to adapt their behavior on daily activities? Doing a capacity analysis to see if the service model that you have and the number of clients and what you want to do for them, whether it's even reasonable. You know, for example, with my practice, I had set up this grandiose, you know, plan to be able to touch my top clients every quarter. And when we started actually scheduling it, we were close to what you were talking about. We had 2,200 hours and 2,000 hours. Something had to give. So as you do these assessments, that assessment is key. Is what you're doing today aligned with the vision of what you're trying to do? Is your structure appropriate? And are your roles and responsibilities and the functions on the team proper for what you need to do?
So are the structure, the roles and responsibilities appropriate and aligned with where you're trying to get to as a team? Are you clear about where you're trying to get to as a team? And do you have the clarity? But more importantly, does the rest of the team have the clarity and also the buy-in to be able to accomplish this? Because clearly a leader isn't going to be able to do all of this alone. Advisors are heroes, absolutely. But there's a reason that we're also surrounded by a team and we work effectively with a team when everybody is bought in.
Well, and the final thing to that is the actual execution. Right. And so you can have the best strategy in the world. You can have the best structure. But if you don't set up an accountability structure to make sure that you're communicating with each other, that you are executing, then most of it is for nothing, because you don't have a way to know if you're moving forward. You don't have a way to know if you need to reverse course. And so as you're thinking about that, you can do that through a team meeting structure, setting up meetings. And teams, when I tell teams that, I hear every team member say, oh, another meeting. Meetings can be highly effective if they're done in the right way and in the right agenda for what you're trying to accomplish. What teams try to do is cram everything into one big meeting. And if it doesn't relate to me as the staff, then why am I here? I have so much to do. And so you have to think about dividing up your meetings and your accountability communication structure to be appropriate, to have the right people in the meetings, to get the right things done, and leave with an actual action step where people own actual activities and things that happen after that meeting.
Tina, so I've heard you talk about a model that you describe as the RACI model when you're talking with teams about ensuring that everybody knows what their different roles and responsibilities are at almost like a minute task level, so that there's, you know, clear communication. Can you, maybe it seems like a good spot here that could be helpful for others listening today. Could you maybe explain that model and how might that be applied in a team setting?
Absolutely. So when we do work with team members and we look at the individual task and activities on the team, a lot of times, and I was probably the worst offender of this as a team leader, you know, many times we get too involved in the actual task, you know, that happened. And being able to empower our team to make decisions and be able to go through workflow without me actually stepping in and taking over was difficult, right? So we had to think about how to create a structure to know who should be involved when and how to actually create that accountability model. And it is RACI, it's R-A-C-I. It stands for responsible. So who has to be responsible for something? Whose inbox does this activity or role or tactic really belong to? Who has the ultimate responsibility if it doesn't work properly? Who has the ultimate authority to make the decision about it? And then there is approve, because, you know, with any task, and at any certain level within the team, everyone may not have full approval authority to just do anything. So thinking through who has to approve it, it may even go beyond your team, whether you're working with your compliance department or your marketing department, making sure that, you know, you get the proper approvals to also make sure you're compliant as well. So who do you need to go to get an actual approval or a task or something you're trying to execute on? And then the third one is who simply has to be consulted, because that's really a basic critical thinking skill, you know, of thinking about what information do you need to bring in and the decision-making process. And sometimes that's within the team if you need a certain type of expertise to help in the decision-making process. Sometimes it's getting input from people outside of the team that you want to leverage, you know, to help you think through the things that you want to do. Not necessarily approve, but get their input. The last one is informed. So, you know, for me as an advisor, something happened in the client accounts. Maybe we made a mistake and we bounced a check on the account by mistake. You know, that's always a huge issue. But I didn't need for my team members to come to me and say, you know, do you want to fix this and give me the activity or take me through the process even that you had to go to fix it. I wanted to know that it was fixed right away. And I wanted to know that you knew the process and the people to get it done. But I didn't necessarily need to be in an approval person on it, or I didn't need for you to consult with me about how I wanted you to handle it. But I simply need to know that it actually happened and that it got fixed, because I would not want to be taken by surprise if a client told me that and I didn't know.
I love that. So RACI stands for responsible, accountable, consulted, and informed. I think that's incredibly valuable. Just, I can see how in terms of, as we think about roles and responsibilities and structure and different processes, having that role clarity of, you know, what is my function in this task or in getting this task? And I can see how you can break that down into micro tasks and also into macro tasks, can be really, really helpful and be a really helpful guide for the team members as well, so that they can understand what their responsibility is with respect to every task to help keep it moving. Tina, this has been a wealth of information. I mean, we've sort of covered what are the four drivers of, you know, a successful practice. We've dove deep into having a disciplined investment process. We dove deep into teaming and how should I be thinking about my team, especially in light of what I might have learned and what we each might have learned together and individually about ourselves and about our team, about our processes, and how we might want to, you know, consider tweaking things or maybe revamping things entirely as we look into 2021 planning. It sounds like through this practice of the future exercise, not only will, you know, can we hone in on what are those key priorities, what's keeping me up at night, either because I'm fearful of it or because I'm excited about it, right? It can sort of come from both angles. But then actually being able to have an accountability partner outside of my team that can help guide me and my team as we move forward with ambitious plans for maximizing our potential in 2021 and beyond.
And it's especially important now with best interests that you really do take a critical look at your practice to see where the business model is going and what you need to get in front of now.
Terrific. Well, thank you, Tina. Thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day coaching many, many advisors, being on webcasts for hundreds of advisors. I know you have been extremely busy, so we really appreciate you taking the time out of your day and joining us today on the podcast.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for joining us. We will be back again soon with another episode of the Helping Advisors podcast. This episode of the Helping Advisors podcast was recorded on July 9th in our respective home offices in Seattle and St. Louis. And as always, great thanks go out to our wonderful editor, producer, and sound engineer, Conrad Piper Ruth. Thank you, Conrad.